Hello everybody, my name is Mamun, and this is Mamun's Gadget Talk for Monday, 5th of October, 2020. In today's episode, we have a lot to talk about, so let's just jump straight in. The first couple of minutes, obviously, the next couple of minutes, we're going to talk about everything Apple related, because Apple, the new iPads and Apple Watch have come out, and obviously, they're really good devices. If you have the money, go get them if you want to. But in the next week or so, Apple will release brand new iPhones, along with hopefully the AirTags, the AirPod Studios, which have been kind of leaked at this point, and a brand new Apple TV. But first, we probably should talk about the iPhone. Now, we've probably been talking about the iPhone 12 series for the last couple of weeks, and how it's going to be, how much it's going to cost, what are we going to be getting? Are we going to have a high refresh rate display? Are we going to have a 120 hertz display? Will we get 5G on it? Will we not get 5G on it? We've talked about this at length in the last couple of weeks. So if you want to go back, just go back and look at episodes titled with iPhone 12 on it, title on it, and in the title, and go have a listen to that if you want to. But in terms of more details and leaks, the last 2 weeks have not really been that slow moving. We've heard quite a lot about the new iPhones. To information like the iPhone 12 will probably be coming out a little earlier than usual in South Korea. Obviously, it'll come out in October to November, but obviously it will come out quickly in October, end of October in South Korea to compete with LG and Samsung. This is what I've heard. Also, I mean, quite a lot has come out. So, at least a week or so back, I mean, we didn't really cover this because it wasn't really a big enough of a story, but now we have the time to go through it. Famous leaker John Prosser tweeted this out, that, and I'll quote him here, "Apple's first shipment of final iPhone 12 units is going out to distributors October 5th. The shipment includes iPhone 12 mini 5.4, definitely the final marketing name, and obviously with the storage starting at 64 gigabytes, going up all the way up to 256 gigabytes, and then the iPhone 12 6.1, 64, 128, 256 event on October 13th, as I mentioned before." And then he replied, and then he added to his tweet, previous tweet, "Don't worry, the iPhone 12 Pro and Pro Max start at 128 GB. So his claim is that the iPhone 12 mini and iPhone 12 will start 64 gigabytes, and then the Pro models will start 120 gigabytes, which makes a hell of a lot of sense, given that 64 is not really enough for high-end phone users, as you can think about it. So that's that, really. You know, so it's quite fascinating what we have here with these devices. Oh, and did I forget to mention, this was basically last week when we were talking about the Google event, so this kind of went past my radar. But more than everything, the naming scheme, a lot of leakers have confirmed and analysts have confirmed that this year's iPhone 12 series will have four phones: the slightly small 5.3-inch iPhone 12 mini, an iPhone 12 Pro, which is going to be just like the iPhone 11, so it'll be main. It'll have a fast processor, decent display and everything, and full-fledged cameras. The iPhone 12 Pro, and then the iPhone 12 Pro Max. There's no S. I don't know. I'm sure they don't have time to put in 11S. It's probably just a mouthful to say that iPhone 11. Imagine if they did that instead of the iPhone 12, they said the iPhone 11s, the iPhone 11s Pro Max plus plus plus. Okay, that's a mouthful. So this kind of came last week too, and there's this leaker Duan Rui on Twitter, and he tweeted this out: iPhone 12 mini, iPhone 12, 12 Pro, iPhone 12 Pro Max, silicon case stickers. So he kind of showed a picture of sort of stickers at the back of Apple's cases they sell for the iPhones, confirming not only the model numbers for all the iPhones in question, well, the model numbers for those products, but also the names of the upcoming iPhones, essentially. So completely, there'll be an iPhone 12 mini, which is kind of interesting because we didn't see it coming from anywhere. Now everyone's saying they're thinking of applying to buy new iPhones, going like, what will they have? What will the iPhone 12 I mean, what will all the iPhone 12 phones offer this year? I mean, I want to spend $1,000. They got to give something worth it. Now, those have been rumoring, and analysts and rumorists have all kind of going like, well, there are probably going to be all four iPhones will have 5G on it. The Pros will have 5G on it. The Pro Max can do millimeter wave 5G. The 12 Pro Max could have 120 hertz display. We really exactly don't know because the information is all over the place. But it's kind of expected that the iPhone 12 mini will be 5.4 inches. The iPhone 12 and 12 Pro both be 6.1 inches. And then the iPhone 12 Pro Max will be 6.7 inches, which is going to be the biggest of any iPhone, really. Obviously, the bezel-less, so it'd be a bit compact, more compact like the iPhone 11 series. 5G is kind of confirmed at this point. I mean, we've been hearing a lot about, and carriers have kind of stated that there'll be a 5G iPhone coming soon. Some carriers have announced it. I mean, to their staff that Apple could launch a 5G iPhone this year, which means that it's well in their knowledge. And so that's the interesting part. And yeah, and obviously the iPhone 12 series would obviously come with the A14, Apple A14 processor, and something or something similar to it, hopefully. But the higher refresh rate is obviously up for debate, given that, again, in a recent episode I stated that, I don't remember who was it really, but they stated that the higher refresh rate was kind of on delay because it impacted battery life and it was not really ready for prime time. So really, we don't know much until the last minute, really. But there you go, guys. We have four iPhones coming this year, which is going to be interesting. But the pricing was interesting. The iPhone 12 mini will start from $649, which is quite competitive with a lot of options on the market. And obviously, the iPhone 12 will start from $699 or $749, hopefully, in that price bracket. Like the iPhone 11 of last year, that started around $700 for a lot of consumers. And that's quite competitive with the market, really. That probably could mean Apple could own that price segment dramatically. There's OnePlus and Samsung, and then obviously Google, all competing for that $500 to $700 price market. Apple could absolutely dominate it. They got a strong lineup this year. The 12 and 12 mini come out under $700. You know, they lock in at $600 to $700, and then you have the SE, the new 2020 iPhone SE. And altogether, if you combine that, it's a strong, affordable iPhone lineup for this year. They probably could move a lot of iPhones. And also, this year has been quite crazy. I don't have to lecture to you how crazy 2020 has been. And some people don't really have $1,000 in their pocket. So this year is especially competitive. If you talk about the $500 to $700 price tag, a lot of people want to buy a new phone, but they don't have quite a lot of money compared to when they had enough money to buy a $1,000 phone. So really, it's quite an aggressive time. So that's the iPhone 12 series. All we do know is that the event's on October 13th. So the next couple of days, Apple probably send invites. Well, probably next week we'll learn more. They're going to send invites and stuff. Hopefully they do finally announce the iPhone 12. I think the whole world's been waiting almost forever for the iPhone 12. So that's something to look forward to. And then we have the iPad Air 4. Now, they announced it last month, but it's not available on sale yet. It's expected to launch. It's going to be going on sale this month. And already, marketing materials are arriving at Apple stores. This is coming from Mac Rumors. This is their reporting. But someone, a leaker called Love to Dream, has sort of posted a Geekbench result for the iPad Air 4. Based on the Mac Rumors report. This was spotted by Ice Universe on Twitter. Cool guy as always. Let me see. He posted this result straight away from Geekbench. The iPad 13/2, or it's iPad 13,2, which is sort of a code name for the iPad Air 4. And the Geekbench result shows that the multi-core score is 4,198, with a single core score of 1,583, for those who don't really know what I'm talking about. Which essentially means that the iPad Air 4 And also in the same Geekbench result, it's shown that the iPad Air 4 has 3.66 gigabytes of RAM with a with a clock speed of 2.99 gigahertz, roughly 3 gigahertz out of the gate, 6 cores out of the window. I mean, it already was a 6-core CPU. It was announced in the event back then. So this is a tad bit higher than the previous A-series chip, the A13 Bionic. And it's dramatically a little, and it's a tad bit faster than the A12Z and the iPad Pro. But this kind of means that there'll probably be a MacBook with the A14. Maybe there could be an A14Z, because Apple does release, or A14X chipset. They may have a higher clock version, a higher speed version of the A14 processor, and that can be going to the Mac straight away, because Apple is going to be moving their Macs to Apple Silicon chipsets, which are essentially A-series chips, but they're much, much faster for computing, for general personal computers and laptops. So that probably... But it's quite interesting that look at this Geekbench score, it's a tad bit faster than a top spec MacBook Pro, which means that they might offer it on the Apple Silicon Macs eventually. The performance quadrant, the overall performance speed of these devices are coming up to a level that they can be put on computers and they can run real quick. But the thing is, the transition to Apple Silicon is quite significant. It's going to be a lot of work, and it's obviously going to take a year or two for Apple to move everything to ARM chipsets. So that's quite interesting development that we're seeing here, to say the least. But then moving past it, and then there's the Apple TV. The Apple TV app and Apple TV Plus has been phenomenal. I mean, in fact, the Apple TV app will be coming to Xboxes down the road. Based on another report I saw last week, where it showed the Apple TV app was already offered to Xbox Insider members so they could test it out. So Apple is clearly focused on services. It's a big part of the business already. But let's just talk about the set-top box that started it all, really, the Apple TV, which actually is based on the Mac Mini, if you think about it. The Mac Mini with the media player software called Front Row, this is how I remember it, and then they released a similarly sized box called the Apple TV that just ran that software and ran stuff from iTunes, and the rest was history, pretty much. One of the best-selling streaming boxes out there, really, started as a sort of a Mac Mini that can run a media player connected to a TV over HDMI, so that's interesting. I mean, the thing is, Apple doesn't really completely build up stuff. It is evolution, really. It's a result of years of innovation. So, but they are working on a brand new Apple TV. Apparently, a leaker called Fudge at @chocolate_bit on Twitter, and this person wrote that, and quoting him or her here, and that is that Apple Arcade is getting big money poured into it. There are currently titles in the works that are aiming to rival the likes of Breath of the Wild, which is why new A12X or Z Apple TV and A14X-like Apple TV and controller are in the works. Some games will require A13 and up to run, which means that Apple is obviously starting to put more focus into Apple Arcade to make it a strong gaming service compared to, say, Xbox Game Pass or obviously the competition that's out there, or like EA Player stuff. And so they're obviously pushing to get some seriously AAA games coming out. But as a result, with all that high-quality gaming, they obviously want a streaming box that can showcase those almost AAA games on a big-screen TV. And so you probably have an upcoming... And then hence there's a brand-new Apple TV that's coming out. Apparently there are two Apple TVs that will probably come out eventually. One is a base, sort of a base-tier Apple TV that runs an A12 processor. And then there's an A14, and then there's an Apple TV running on an A14 processor, which would be very, very fast. The A14 chip Apple TV would probably be fast enough for gaming, and obviously have much higher storage configuration to play AAA games and to utilize Apple Arcade. They probably could do that, and obviously Apple could be working on a controller. We just don't know yet, really, but that's kind of awesome, really. A12 Apple TV would be kind of nice. Highly updated, pretty high speed. could make you, it makes streaming in 4K HDR great again, but also it helps with playing some very light titles and some work, assuming you want to do that, really. And also smart home capabilities. Let's not forget the Apple TV is also a HomeKit hub. So any performance upgrades it can get can help in that matter and manner in that regard. So cool news that we're hearing, really, with the Apple TV, quite literally, if you think about it, it's getting a new variant, which is kind of interesting, to say the least. So, I mean, can't wait. Then moving past to the Surface Duo from Microsoft. Microsoft's first sort of foldable Android phone. Apparently, an interesting story here is that there's basically been users of the Surface Duo that have bought it and using it for a while have reported on Reddit that the USB-C port, or the area around the USB-C port, has been kind of chipping off because it's really thin. It's like kind of a little brittle. It's like just chipping off. This is from the stories from Android Central. Surface Duo owners have gone to Reddit to share photos of cracked USB-C ports. Several people online report that the body around the Surface Duo's USB-C port has cracked or even chipped off in some cases. Some reports emerged around the Surface Duo's launch, but the number of cracked devices appear to have increased over this past weekend. Reddit user FogAnime shared an image that showed a piece of the Surface Duo's body completely chipped off. Others, such as Reddit user Magnern Archer, have a crack around the Surface Duo's USB-C port, sort of along with like a little picture to it, and it clearly looks like it was either cracked or chipped off, which is kind of interesting because it's so thin, so that's a likelihood. At this point, it's impossible to tell how widespread this issue is. Although reports seem to be climbing on the Surface Duo subreddit, there's also a chance that the cracks and chips occurred from people dropping their devices. People state in the comments that they've been gentle with the Surface Duo and that the cracks sometimes occurred when just plugging into the device. Which is kind of... this is weird. This is a weird phenomenon happening here. It's a design issue. I think the fact that the Surface Duo is like quite thin, like already as it, I mean, you fold it, it's just its thickness, combined thickness is like another phone. But if you fold it out completely, it's so thin that I'm not that much surprised that the chips and, you know, it's chipped from the sides and stuff. Oh well, what can you do about it if you own a Surface Duo, if you're scared of it? Do yourself a favor, just get a bumper case. There's already one in the box, but then also you can get third-party bumper cases. Just go on Amazon, have a look. You'll probably be able to find bumper cases for it. That's what my solution is to you all out there, is to just find a bumper case. So it's a genuine problem, but it's not that big of a deal, really. I mean, but it's just a consequence of the design of these devices. So that's that, really. So if you're that concerned, go get a bumper case. That's what I'd say. But it's a genuine problem. I think Microsoft should do something about it. I did see a little thumbnail of a video from JRig Everything again, where he kind of stress tested the Surface Duo, and he wasn't able to put it back together, or that's what the thumbnail showed. I didn't watch the video yet, so I can't comment on that, on what the what was in the video, really. But it was let's just say it's quite Microsoft's first foldable's durability is quite stress tested already, and it's not really the strongest of devices. If you want a tough phone, get an LA phone. That thing can handle bumps and cracks, or just get a Nokia 3300. That thing can survive nuclear bomb blasts, that's for sure. So, as a gentle reminder to everyone who owns a phone or wants to get a phone, always get a thick or bumper case. Thank me later on that, okay? That's the thing. So, yeah. So, we've obviously talked already about Apple devices and obviously Surface Duo, but you know, the little parts of owning devices is charging. Let's face it, you have to keep everything charged up, and obviously having five six wall plugs is quite annoying. Or imagine, you know, always have that problem. You plug one wall charger in, and that's it, game over. And that's the only one socket in that room or part of your house. Well, what I'm about to talk to you about is quite radical in that regard. Solves many problems at once. We're talking, obviously, the good folks over at Hyper have started a crowdfunding campaign for their really cool new charger, which has a gallium nitride circuit, so it can handle higher currents and voltages. The Hyperjuice stackable gallium nitride charger, and comes in two variants, a 65 watt variant for mobile charging for smartphones and wearables and all that good stuff, and a 100 watt USB-C variant. Also, is a little thick, a little longer, a little bigger, and that can charge your MacBook, your regular laptop. In fact, my laptop, which I'm recording this on, can charge from this adapter, mind you. This is using USB. This is through USB power delivery. There are adapters that can find AliExpress. I definitely want to consider this. Hyper, if you're watching or listening to this, then please do consider sending me one of your chargers. It would be lovely. But for a note for our listeners outside the US, you can't get this if you're living abroad. You won't able to buy this. They won't ship outside US because apparently, even if you're using a stackable function, you can't. It won't work with a adapter, plug adapter, because it would probably burst. It would short or burst the circuit out because it can't handle the 1500 watt pass through power. So they're not gonna help you in that if you do that and your plug sockets burst. So I mean, they're not responsible, but they're not offering it to folks out of the US yet, which is kind of a bummer. I'd love to buy a 3-pin plug version of this. It would be quite popular, but they probably made one for the US 2-pin plug, which is interesting. But such a really cool gallium nitride charger. This thing is on Kickstarter. This is on Kickstarter if you want to go get it. It's raised less than $400,000. So it's basically been funded four times over than its initial target. So there's a compact 65-watt charger, and then there's a 100-watt kind of charger. So the 65-watt charger has three USB ports, so two USB Cs and one USB A, and then the 4-port variant has an additional USB C port, but the total capacity jumps to 100 watts. And also, mostly it's USB-C to obviously charge your USB-C devices. It can handle fast charging, so you can obviously charge up your phone and tablet and a wearable or so. And also, the interesting thing is that the design is quite compact. You can throw this into a bag, and you won't scratch your devices around it because it has a fold. The pins come out. And also the interesting thing, the stackable part comes from the other 2-pin plug, the US 2-pin plug socket that's literally on top of the charger. When you plug it into a wall, it's right in front. So you can essentially plug another device, another appliance on it. And earlier I mentioned how you have if there's just one plug socket and you just put one charger on it, then it's game over. That pass-through port means you can plug more outlets, and so you can get two of these and essentially have how many outlets that will be. Let's see, the base 3-port option, if you get two of those and plug them in and just plug them straight into the wall, you have 6 ports of charging. And obviously, if you don't need to charge three more devices, you just take it off and off you go. It's quite compact and really, really cool, and it solves a lot of problems at once. Oh, and since the pass-through port can do up to 1.5 megawatts. This means you can't use it with an adapter because, again, it'll burst out the circuit because it'll be full of high current and voltage. But obviously, you can plug. You can go all the way up to 4 sockets, and you could charge 4 laptops or tablets, really. So, If you have the 100 watt variant, you can put 16 of these back to back, and you basically get 48 USB-C ports and 16 USB-A ports. This is the theoretical maximum of this device. And it's quite compact compared to the market options that are available out there, including Apple's chargers and obviously from brands like Anker, which is interesting. And obviously, this is powered, and also that all this compactness and fast charging is thanks to that gallium nitride circuitry, especially the industry-leading Navitas GaN Fast Power IC, which means that it can handle higher voltages, but obviously it'd be quite efficient, and it doesn't heat up all that dramatically fast, which is cool. So pretty interesting device, really. It's quite a compact monster. So it can support 100 and 240 volt charging circuits. So if you live on anywhere in the world, this can work with an adapter, but you cannot use the stackable function, which is where you add additional ports. Again, that'll burst the circuits out, as I earlier said. But the maximum you can go with, say, the 65 watt variant is 20 volts and 3.25 amps, which can do virtually all kinds of fast charging that is out there at 100 watts. And some folks don't have fast charging any faster than 20 or 30 volts at the watts at the moment, which is quite interesting. So you all be thinking, I mean, I want to get this. Oh, and as always with kickstarting, with crowdfunding campaigns, there's obviously the usual risk of it's not going to be available. You won't be able to get it until later on. So do keep that in mind. But they have a good solid track record. You can get, right now, you can get, let's see, you can get the 65 watt version for $48 instead of, if you pledge $48 or more, instead of the usual $80 price. You can get the $100 variant for $60 or more and up if you pledge that much money. It's usually, and the 65 watt variant of the Hyperjuice will start $80, and the 100 watt will be available for $100, which I think is a good value. That's basically $1 per watt, which is interesting. And then, and it's going, and it's flying out very, very quickly. So, there was a $40 version that sold out really quickly. So, if you want a Hyperjuice, do get this. It's selling out really quickly, so they probably have filled all the orders. This will be shipping out early next year, so you'll have to wait till then to get one, because it's a lot of effort to make a fast charger. So, I mean, definitely do check this out if you are interested in putting money in a Kickstarter. So, that was the Hyperjuice stackable GaN charger. Definitely recommend it if you're in a market for a compact fast charger and you want to wait a couple of months for it to be at your doorstep. So yeah, I mean, if you're curious. So we've talked a lot about the PS5 already on the show for the last couple of weeks. Obviously the PS5 is already announced. Normally the pre-orders are available. It's sold out. The first wave of consoles is sold out completely. It'll be available on November 19th, all that great stuff. But what we haven't been able to see is the user UI or how the games are, sort of a hands-on. But fortunately, a bunch of Japanese publications are kind of lucky because they got a pretty early hands-on before everyone else of the PS5. And safe to say that obviously a lot of the publications are visibly impressed from the PS5. Now the thing is that they weren't able to see the UI at all anywhere, either in the videos or the publications. Like nowhere they've mentioned the the user interface or the other games. The two games they're able to sort of test were Astro's Playroom, which is sort of like a preloaded kind of test app for the PS4 and also the PS5. It's also going to be on the PS5. And another and an interesting game, Godfall, which is a really good RPG based on what I've heard. And so a lot of the reviews sort of I've opened up both articles, these two publications from Japan, 4Gamer and Denjeki Online, and both have kind of talked, have gotten sort of very early hands-on at the PS5. And so they've visibly been impressed by the immense haptic feedback, the adaptive triggers, obviously enhanced vibration motors giving you a greater haptic feedback, and they've visibly been impressed by it. Surprisingly, is one, okay, according to Denjegi, they've wrote, "Is it like rich but refreshing? Lol," which is obviously if you get the jokes about vibrators and stuff. Where they've written was what one has written here, but the vibration was different in quality. Especially when you actually swing to the controller, you will notice it immediately. Several different vibrations, so the small vibrations and large vibrations, are transmitted at the same time. So basically surprised at sort of the incredible haptic feedback function of the adaptive, the haptic feedback sort of with the adaptive sort of triggers along the along with that, but also to actually start, yeah. So I'm just reading it as we go here. And obviously the reviews of the hands-on review write-ups have also been. They've also written how surprised they were at the fans on the PS5. But the thing I want to mention here is obviously they played Astro's Playroom and Godfall, and those games are not really graphically demanding. So if it's quite quiet, then you know why. I mean, it's not that not that graphically intense or processing heavy. So they're surprised it was really quiet. But then more so, the overall console. It's not that ginormous. It's a little. It's a tad bit bigger. Okay, how do I describe it in size? It's a tad bit taller. It's a little bit taller than the PS4, the original PS4, the one that launched 6 years ago at this point of time. And it's a little bit taller. It's a bit more slender in the videos. And the person showed his hand by comparison, so it's obviously big. And it's quite slender for what it is. Even if you put it vertically or horizontally, which is quite interesting. And also, it was not that overheated, or fans were not really spinning that much. But it was interesting that on the actual console, I think towards the top part, there are like nuts and bolts around it. And everyone's like, what's in that button? What are those bolts and nuts? It's also a mystery. It's really a mystery at this point. What's inside that? Is it the shells? Are these the screws that connect the shells to the body overall? Is it the slot where you pop it out and can and switch out the hard drive? And Sony has said that you can switch out the SSD. We'll have to wait until the PS5 launches, how easy it is to take out the SSD. It's quite easy if you have the PS4 already. The original one, you just pop up the top glossy part of the console and screw in two later, like a laptop hard drive. And then the newer, slimmer PS4s have like this part towards the back, sort of, and you basically pull out a bit like a laptop, changing out a laptop hard drive on a laptop. It's similar. If you have experience of changing out hard drives on a laptop, then surely PS4s are nothing really in that regard. Now, if we talk about Camp Xbox, obviously, changing out the SSD storage inside those consoles will be soldered, but they'll offer a storage expansion slot, so that's interesting. You definitely save up and get a 1 terabyte, that'll probably be enough for now. But the PS5 though we can change the SSD inside it, meaning that it'll probably be a market standard SSD, probably an M.2 or a SATA. M.2 is highly likely given the transfer speeds you get with M.2 storage. So the interesting thing, the folks at Denjeki have written here, while they were playing Godfall, when it becomes game over or when switching maps, it can be restarted in a few seconds, or the map is switched. And when restarting or switching stages, it takes about 1 minute to load. So when playing, I think thinking will change. Kind of surprised, basically being surprised at the overall loading times, which is the big revolution with the PS5, is the overall load times and the overall speed. And then the interesting part is the controller, though. On the controller, aside from the enhanced haptics and stuff and adaptive triggers, the LED around it, you can change colors on it, which is interesting, and it would help because the LEDs, you can, it will show you what player, what team you are exactly on, who you are on the match. Kind of a nice identifier. The interesting thing is the Western publications haven't really gotten their own hands on yet, so the Japanese game game publications have got early in advance, which is interesting, and they're visibly impressed by the overall experience. So we'll have to see, wait and see for next month. Man, it can't come sooner. So very fun times ahead. Who will dominate, though? That's the interesting question. Will Xbox win here or PlayStation? We'll have to wait and see. It'll probably be depending on what kind of games they have on launch day or in the next 6 months. So if Xbox has more exciting games, then it will win here. But the real competition is streaming, as I've earlier said in previous episodes previously, that the real competition for this generation of games consoles is going to be game streaming services like Stadia and Amazon's Luna service and all the other, and GeForce Now and stuff. So that's going to be interesting for sure. So definitely fun times ahead. And finally, this is not really related to technology. It's really a little close to me, but it's kind of fascinating to talk about. So if you, I don't know about you, if you go to the movies or you go to the cinemas, but this is interesting because it's quite a big deal because it's been reported a lot everywhere. But Regal Cinemas and Cineworld will reportedly close all theaters in the US and UK starting next week because apparently James Bond's latest film, the latest 007 film, No Time to Die, has basically been delayed from November of this year. It was stated to release in May, but then delayed to November, and then now they're going to be releasing it in April. Basically, all of sort of the top summer and fall 2020 blockbuster releases have kind of been delayed to next year, and then some slightly, there could have been hits, but they were going to be there though. They moved to streaming. A lot of movies have moved to streaming. We all know that. Enola Holmes, which was this really cool movie about Sherlock Holmes's equally investigative sister, is now on Netflix. If you have Netflix, go watch it. That's interesting. Even Borat's sequel, I've heard about. Borat's sequel. That's going to be on Amazon Prime, mind you. So, and Mulan has gone to Disney Plus, though. So a lot of movies have kind of been off the theaters, sort of, because of the pandemic. But more than interesting is that some of the bigger chains have been genuinely been affected in the West, including Cineworld, which is a big cinema chain in the UK, and they've been affected. They obviously have been affected by the pandemic and obviously the low attendance numbers. Cinemas did reopen in the UK, but obviously not many people have been going because they've been pretty scared about catching the virus and while watching a movie. So a lot of people are obviously sitting at home and watching movies and they're streaming it and stuff. And so they're shutting down, they're temporarily closing their cinemas, which is interesting. And the interesting part is this company has lost $1.6 billion in the first half of 2020. Now, obviously, Cineworld is not the only chain that has been that's been suffering from the coronavirus pandemic. AMC Cinemas, which is the biggest American movie theater chain, has been burning money, really, because their theaters have mostly been closed around the U.S., most of them, not all of it. So it's been a pretty hard time for the movie theater sector, for the cinema industry, really. So the cinema distribution sector, really, that part of Hollywood, really. I mean, movies are changing as we know it, really. The model is transforming. The theatrical window has completely been shattered, as you could say now. And now movies are releasing almost at the same time as streaming and stuff. So that's quite interesting. But more interesting is a lot of big blockbusters have been moving their release schedules, and that's genuinely affected cinemas and their ability to make money. And so, cinemas have been probably the most affected of any establishment or physical establishment during this whole pandemic. Restaurants haven't suffered much because there's food ordering and stuff. So, I kind of digress. So that's the world we live in, really. I mean, it's all digitalized. So that was the podcast. Thank you for listening. Obviously, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, share it to your friends. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @Sayed_my99. Until Wednesday, this is your boy signing out. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Ciao. Thanks for listening.